From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. A new study of very young children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder has linked their response to language to future skill development. The study was headed up by Dr. Patricia Kuhl, who co-directs the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, iLabs for short, and I'm delighted to have Dr. Kuhl in the studio with me today.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Wonderful to be here.
Let's start off with who you studied exactly.
Okay, so in this study, this is a very large study where we're bringing in children through a clinical diagnosis that gives them a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder at the age of two.
Wow.
And this is a massive study in which we plan ahead of time to study them at the age of two, then again at the age of four, and then again at the age of six. And my role in the study is to do the initial measures at age two of language. And so we had the exciting opportunity to decide what do we want to measure. And we landed on work that we'd been doing with typically developing children on a brain signature that has to do with the recognition of words that you know.
A brain signature means what part of your brain activates?
It's not only what part, but it's what it looks like. What is that brain signature? We call it a signature because it's a pattern of brain waves that happens at a particular point in time and takes a particular shape and is in a particular location.
And maybe you want to explain how you're able to do that.
Right. Well, in this study, we're using event-related potentials. And what that means is that you are the children, the babies can be measured even, are wearing a nylon cap and it has sensors in it. And the sensors just sitting on the scalp are able to pick up the brain waves that sort of leak from the scalp as the brain does its work. And the particular stimulus that you play, like a word or a syllable that is contained in the language, has a very characteristic brainwave response that's picked up by these sensors.
Now, that is based on work you've been doing work for many years on language development.
Yes.
And so I assume that's why you thought, well, okay, well,
we'll do words. Yeah.
So did you then bring in a pool of kids and start measuring?
Or? So the two-year-olds enter the study through a process of the clinical evaluation. Mm-hmm. And then we were, and there's a selected control group because you always want to compare the responses that you're measuring against typical controls. And so at the age of two, we brought both groups into the laboratory, and the task is quite simple. We talk to parents ahead of time about what words their child knows. Mm-hmm. We take very common words, milk, cup, that kind of thing. And we compare known words and ask mothers, does your child know this word? Maybe sometimes they're producing the word, but do they know this word? And then we pick a group of unknown words that are words of English, simple single syllable words, but ones that a two-year-old is not going to know yet, like mast, you know, the words at tube that they're not likely to know. And so the baby child, this is a two-year-old, sitting on a mom's lap and has something to distract them, and an assistant is sort of manipulating some quiet toys while the baby, this child, is listening to the words, and both known words and unknown words, and we're looking for this signature response to known words.
And what you found was really fascinating because in the control group, the typically developing children, the brain responds in one place, but in depending on how severe the autistic, where they are on the spectrum, it was different parts of the brain that responded?
Okay, so here's what happens. On the left temporal parietal lobe, so right above your ear on the left side, typically developing children are showing this very different waveform when they hear a known word as opposed to an unknown word. And we looked at the children with autism, and when you look at them at a group as a group, it's just not there. It's simply absent. But when you do a more careful look at the children with autism and divide them into two groups based on the severity of their social symptoms, ones that are really severely socially impaired, as opposed to ones that are not so socially impaired, because we know that children on the spectrum are widely varying, what we saw in the children who are less socially impaired is a more typical response on the left, in that left location. And again, in the children with more severe symptoms, not seeing that response. So we took this measure, once we had identified it does exist in some children with autism, at the electrode location P3 on the left.
Okay, I'm sure somebody knows what that means.
Some do. It's on the left, above your left ear.
Okay.
So we use that to predict the future for all the children with autism. So meaning we take that measure and we say, how strongly did the brain at the age of two respond to known words? And we use that to try to predict the outcomes of measures that we took at age four and age six. And the measures we took at four and six were very large batteries of standardized tests that were either in the linguistic domain, in the cognitive domain, or in what we call adaptive behavior domain. And these are standardized against large numbers of children.
Okay.
The outcome was really surprising, that this predictor at age two predicted better than anything else we know at the age of four and six, got better over time. So it's even a stronger predictor at age six than at age four, and not only predicted language abilities in these children, but their cognitive abilities and their adaptive behaviors.
Okay, so now my brain, whatever part of my brain, just exploded, and I thought, well, what does that tell us about typically developing brain and a brain of maybe a child who's pretty far on the has more difficulties with their social interactions? They're the kids who didn't have any kind of response in that left part of their brain.
Right. So we have a theory. It's called the social gating hypothesis. We think that skills that are delivered through cultural experience, through a social experience in a particular country and society, is this kind of social gate that as a child, you have to be both interested in the social other, and that enables you to provide yourself with more information by watching the behaviors of that person, by looking at what they look at as they name things, by trying to read their intentions, by looking at their actions and everything about what they do. It's like tapping the inside of that person's social mind. And secondly, we think there's a motivational component that even beyond the information you gain, that just being in the mere presence of another human being changes your motivational level. Mm. We like to think of the brain being turned on in a new way in the presence of another person. And so this social gate is what we think sort of modulates the more computational, calculating brain that also works to acquire words and sounds and grammar of the language. So this computational component we've been studying and others have been studying for since the 1990s, mm-hmm. that we can predict what you might learn from listening to Japanese as opposed to English,
right,
using probabilistic statistics to say, what is it that's contained? What are the syllables and how are they arranged? But this new idea adds something to that, to say, yes, there is a computational component. You have to be able to learn statistically, so to speak, mm-hmm. but that the gate has to be there. This social gate is the way to get into that analysis.
We're talking with Dr. Patricia Kuhl, who's the co-director of the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences at the University of Washington. And you mentioned you have been studying for years this sort of the way that, in the most simplistic terms that I can understand it, the way that we form the pathways in our brains to learn many things. And so are you saying that this might show us, in addition to this social gating, how if you have this particular disorder, a brain might develop differently?
Yes. I think that children with autism see the world through a different lens. And if we understood the lens, we might be able to arrange the world in interventions that would allow them to be interested in that information. So we all know there's a critical period with regard to language. So mm-hmm. there's a window of opportunity when the brain is ready for that information. And if our social gating hypothesis is true, that gate has to be open. If it's not open, then those computational mechanisms don't do their job. What we're trying to imagine as a future possibility is that we believe our measure at the age of two is a measure of that enormous complexity that a child at two who recognizes a known word using this left hemisphere area is showing the combination of computational and social skills, which take place in two different parts of the brain and have to be united. So if we can arrange a situation in future interventions that is sufficiently entertaining, interesting, and grabbing to a child with autism, you could use that lens, get in there with the information, and change the course of history for that child and that child's family.
Because you'll help form that pathway.
You'll make the pathway resemble the kind of information that that child is interested in. So it's that the brain is behaving differently, looking through, seeing the world through a different lens than the child who's typically developing. But it's not as though that lens doesn't function. And let me give you another example. In an earlier study, we'd given toddlers with autism and typically developing children a choice of listening to either motherese or a sine wave analog.
So motherese would be, oh, honey.
Hello. How are you?
Right.
Let's see your big blue eyes.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
better with a two-monther in your hand. Okay. So we gave them the choice of listening to snippets of that, 8 seconds from different mothers, not their own, against the sine wave analog. So that's a pure tone analog that takes all the important components and on their amplitudes and timing presents a signal that sounds like a computer warble, blah, 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 something like that. And typically developing kids will listen to it once in a while, but they don't prefer it. Whereas children with autism tended to prefer the non-speech analog, you know, this pure tone analog. And the more they prefer it, the more severe their autistic symptoms. Now, at least what that shows is that there is a preference for a complex auditory signal if you can capture something about what that signal means about their brain's lens on the world, on the auditory world, you might be able to capitalize on it.
You have your entree into all of this, as I mentioned earlier, was the idea of where we how we acquire language and sort of what that opens up for us. At what point did you turn your focus to autistic brains?
Well, I think that the discovery we made in 2003 was a turning point for my laboratory, and that was one in which we exposed typically developing nine-monthers to a foreign language for the first time, and we were on the computational hypothesis saying, well, what happens if a baby has to statistically compute information from a brand new language for the first time at 9 months? Can they do it? And so we arranged this very natural situation. Kids are playing on the floor with my foreign-speaking graduate students and postdocs, and they come in 12 times over a month's time. What we discover is they learn phenomenally live, but when you do the same material, the same dosage over a television set, beautiful DVDs, or audio only, and they watch a teddy bear on the screen, no learning whatsoever occurs, even though they stare at the screen a lot. So we developed this social gating hypothesis based on that. It then clicked that the study of autism, which is this twin deficit in social and language, also shows this linkage between the two, and it made very, very good sense.
And also underlying that, it sounds like, is that that our brains at two, and possibly even now, at least I hope it's the case, are plastic, that there is the possibility of, if something is not quite typically connected, that we can form another connection that would allow us to do the task,
right?
Because there's so many things in there.
Exactly. So we learn beautifully all our lives, but we learn differently. And so there are some domains in which there are clear limitations in your ability to learn at different ages. So language is one of those in which biologists describe the critical period phenomenon. It applies quite soundly. So you bring your three-year-old to Paris, as we did when our three-year-old
was three,
and she was absorbing the vocabulary and the sentence structure, and we're dumbfounded by her ability to just grab it up, just suck it up, just sponge it up, and certainly what was going on in her brain was not going on in ours, and that's been repeated over and over again. That between 0 and 7, your capacity to acquire new languages is totally different than it is after that. It doesn't say you can't acquire it, but you'll acquire it with different brain mechanisms and with different facility.
Oh, that's sad news for me and my age.
Yes, me too.
The last time you and I spoke, you were in Washington, D.C. It was just as the president's proposed brain mapping initiative was hitting the news, and then everything got silent. So I was wondering if you could give us a brief update about...
There's a lot of activity worrying in the background. So the first $100 million that the president has dedicated to this brain initiative is likely to go at the other end of the spectrum. So if you think about neuroscience, there's two ends of the spectrum. One is to visualize and examine individual neurons, and many of them at once. You want to see them in action. You want to turn them on at will, that kind of thing. And that's typically done in animals and in careful studies at that micro level. We're at the macro level, looking at whole brains operating at once using brain imaging technology. We want to see how the social brain and the language brain does its work together, how memory and language and judgment and all of the really important things that humans only do, how does that work? How do systems interact? So this is called systems neuroscience, and the other side is molecular. The first money, it will eventually try to link these two. So the grand scheme is to take these and bring them closer together. Mm-hmm. They tend to be different scientists with different training, and not much goes bidirectionally. But we've started now to do a lot of work to unify the very exciting stuff happening in molecular neuroscience and then in systems. So I think that a good deal of this initial money will go to the development of new technologies that don't exist right now to see many more individual neurons working, firing.
Well, as you mentioned, new technology, iLabs had a grand celebration when you brought in what was totally cutting-edge technology, which was the, I believe, what you used to measure these two-year-olds' patterns. It's a kind of a helmet with sensors that lets you see things. So we're probably at version 4.0 at this point.
So we, in this study that we've published so far, is using a prior technology, event-related potentials, where the little cap is on the head with the sensors. The new technology looks like a hairdryer from Mars, but it's beautifully $2.5 million machine, completely safe, completely non-invasive, completely noiseless. And the baby just sits there, and a person at any age can sit there and can be entertained with toys or do something if we want to test cognitive problem solving, while this device measures directly the current flow and the magnetic fields that it changes. So now, publications are always running 2 years behind. At the moment, we're doing this paradigm. One of our postdocs is doing this, using this paradigm with MEG technology. And this allows you to see deep sources in the brain and what's being activated as differently for known and unknown words. And that will give us the potential to see more deeply what's different about children with autism and typically developing children. And we're going down to 12 to 14 months. So we want to go earlier because the brain is so plastic during this period, and language has this critical window of opportunity. So all of this has to work in concert. We want to diagnose earlier, show the predictive biomarker, be able to say ahead of time, ahead of the diagnosis, this child is greatly at risk, and that opens up brand new doors.
Oh, it's just fascinating. So at some point, the folks at the Allen Brain Institute are on the very micro level.
Yes.
And you at the systems level are going to meet, and fireworks are going to explode over Lake Union, I'm sure.
They are already.
Patricia Kuhl co-directs the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. Her newest study, for which she's the lead researcher, is a study of, as she mentioned, brain markers for autism and language and what it tells us about children who are diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder and kids who don't, and maybe can intervene earlier to help those kids develop language. Thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is KUOW.